Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Big Jim is wearing his heels.
I'd go to the hotel, the rooftop bar, I would drink as much as I could possibly consume. I'd go to my room, I'd bore my eyes out, I'd get up and do it all the next day for 16 days. It was fucking torture. Front page of the Sunday Independent at home, and I just think of my poor old dad who's no longer with us. The front page said, Doyle hated in Britain. You'd hear, X has died, and I'm in the paddock, and I'm looking at his wife and his kids, his team, and I'm like, I know your husband's dead, and you don't know yet. And I hated that. I thought, fucking cheek of me knowing that. It was just a horrible, horrible time. But the rugby team played throughout that whole time and represented both sides of a warring community, which is an incredible feat. So when we went into camp that night, we just spoke about that, and I just said, this jersey's magic.
On this episode, I'm joined by an Everest window salesman. He's a lot more than that. Wait until you hear this. It's the wonderful Craig Doyle. It's a pleasure to have you in. And
are we now podding?
Yeah, we are now podding.
Is this it? That's your official welcome?
This is it. Well, I'll give you a proper welcome. Yes. You've got the Irish flag behind you. We're in the Spotify studio.
This is amazing. When you think podcasts, you know, where they started, people's bedrooms, etc. And look at this.
I know.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's like a little TV show. Irish flag behind me. Jim, look at
just
that.
Just the little bits of detail that some people pick up, some people don't.
Yeah, well, they're fools to miss it.
I know. But no, it's a pleasure to have you in because you're a guy that I respect. I've enjoyed working with, all the nice things. And I found out in the green room that you were fronting double pane window glass doors, conservatory doors, Everest. You were the face of Everest.
We like to call it UPVC double to triple glazing with a collection of bifolding doors that will literally change your world. And the UPVC is guaranteed to stay white for life, Jim.
That is why you're here, because that detail, the level of detail there blows my mind. I didn't know.
All about detail. 12 years now with Everest Windows and Doors.
Are you still with them?
Yeah.
I didn't even know. I've not done my research.
Well, what you need to do is look at the number of rugby players that call me going, I'm building a house. Dave Flatman calls me monthly.
He doesn't have PVC.
Well, he wants it.
Does he?
Just the back door, though. I don't want the front door.
Okay.
Front of the house listed in Bath, you see. The back door. Either you're a commit, Dave. Either you commit to the UPVC or you can just bugger off. I'm not interested.
Well, I never.
So Ian McGeekins.
He ain't.
Whole house.
No, he isn't.
Yeah, he did the Everest.
He's old school.
He did the Everest conference with me. Whole house.
I'm building a house at the minute. Now, you're going to have to sell me the PVC. Not now, but you're going to have to send me the brochure. I imagine it's paper.
It's UPVC.
What does U mean?
It's different. So, you know, when you look at you think, oh, that's quite classy. There might be like a matte black kind of metal effect. That's UPVC.
Oh, okay.
PVC is the white, shiny stuff.
Yeah, that I'm not.
No.
Yeah.
I'm UPVC. Not
that. There's nothing wrong with that because there'll be listeners here that like...
No, they'll love it. Yeah. They'll draw it. But
durable.
Durable. Stays white for life. Guaranteed for life with Everest Windows and Doors. Summer sale on its way. 0800 010 123.
Is that UK number?
I think it is, yeah.
Is it? Look, hey.
Jim. Always selling.
I know.
You know something? When I started doing... Actually, do you want me to go there on this? Because this is kind of interesting in a weird way, right? So Everest Windows and Doors have a huge part to play in what I do now, because I worked for the BBC for many years, and there was a stage it didn't go particularly well. And then it started going okay again. And they didn't give me a new contract. And then they said, look, just do some rugby, you know, and do some bits and bobs. I was doing triathlon and things like that. And then it came good again and some people left. And they're like, oh, no, now we want you. And I was like, all right. And they wanted to give me a new contract, a long contract. But at the same time, ITV approached me about going over to do rugby and stuff with them. And at the same time, Everest approached me. So I said, okay. So I went into the BBC. I said, thank you very much. It's really nice. Can I do adverts? And they went, well, no, not really. I said, well, Gary Lineker does adverts. Can I do adverts? And they went, no. No, we wouldn't allow that. I said, well, thanks very much. I'm going to ITV. ITV allowed me to do the Everest ads, and that's why I initially moved over.
So BBC would not allow you to do,
wouldn't let me do the Everest
window adverts?
No, they wouldn't.
But they don't even have adverts on BBC.
Well, there you go. Well,
that's the irony.
They don't allow anyone to do adverts. They do have windows, ironically, but they don't have adverts for them. But no, very few people back then, and even now, are allowed to do adverts when you're a BBC face. But ITV didn't mind it. And I went, right, so, because the adverts paid more than any television job had paid me. So that's one of the reasons I went over to ITV. As it happened, the best move I ever made. But yeah, motivated by double glazing.
Well, Everest, what's the full title? Everest Windows
Everest
and Doors?
Everest Windows and Doors.
Everest, well, now it's coming back to me, but they've effectively got one of the biggest plugs to the millions of Big Jim show listeners.
Well, this is the line. Fit the best. Fit Everest.
I am sold.
Like butter, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Like butter. Like butter.
Craig, you're on Good Morning Britain as well.
No, the next one, this morning.
This morning.
Yeah.
So it's got Good Morning and then This Morning After.
So this Good Morning Britain's the newsy show till 10.
Till half nine.
Suzanne Reid. And
the one that Piers Morgan walked off.
Yeah. Then you've got Lorraine with... Lorraine.
Yeah.
And then you've got This Morning, usually with Holly. Lovely Holly.
Yeah.
And lovely Phil.
He's all right.
And so when they go away, Dermot O'Leary and Alison Hammond take over.
Yes.
Now when they go away.
You're in.
I'm in there. I only need a couple of freak accidents to happen to make that gig happen.
And where does my old agent, Andy Peters, fit in? He just does like the weather. Andy, not the weather. He does like the holidays. Competitions.
Yeah. But he loves it. Like, he absolutely loves it. For him, it's a lifestyle business. He's away constantly. It basically pays for his trips.
Well, he's in LA. I saw a post of Tom Evans and Nicole Scherzinger, and they're having what looked like sushi. I've got a funny story on Andy Peters, actually. So when he was vying for me to be his client, it might have been the other way around. I think I was desperate for James Grant to look after me. He took me out to Nobu, which is a famous sushi restaurant. Yeah. It's quite posh. Maybe he wanted me. So
expensive.
It was expensive. But do you think I've ever eaten sushi? Like, born and raised in the Northern Hebrides of Coventry. And he's brought out these green beans. Mm. So I'm smashing these green beans and they are fucking chewy.
Like, I know what's happened here.
They are chewy as anything. And he's laughing his head off and I'm just fucking out. Like, I'm thinking it's a delicacy.
Springy.
What are they? Edamame beans or something? Oh my gosh.
You didn't pop them out of the little pod, did you?
No, I didn't. No. But I did see him the other week outside ITV Studios and he said that still lives with him.
Oh, yeah, he'd love that. Oh. He's ripped.
He is in great shape. He's 50-odd as well.
And Nicole Scherzinger? Said last week, big buff Andy Peters. She said that on television. So
really?
He's doing the competitions this week and I'm on and I go, right, competition time now, £80,000 up for grabs, cash free tax with all the information. It's big buff Andy Peters.
Big arms.
Big arms.
Legs, not too sure.
Doesn't need legs.
No, it doesn't.
Why would you do legs?
Well, it's just the complete package, isn't it?
Which
you don't need. I don't know.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, power. That's where the power comes from.
What do you need? Do you need any of that for? It's literally just how it looks.
You're selling me the dream here. How do I get mainstream? How do I get to tier one media? Not by eating edamame beans.
No. Oh. But, you know, so Andy's on it. It's such a crazy show. I love it because I started off in that kind of world, but I always wanted to do sport and I've been in sport for a long, long time. And you live in a little sports bubble where you think, actually, you know, Northampton Saints halfback combination for the game tonight is literally the most important thing in the world, you know, at that time. But it's actually not. You go and you do something like This Morning. It's 2.5 hours of just stuff. It can be anything. It's HRT to Phil Vickery's Baked Alaska to a performing duck. And people have it on in their homes all day. And it's company for them. And a lot of people, you know, people living on their own or just a bit lonely, they have this thing on, this familiar wallpaper. So it plays a really important role in people's lives. And when you cop onto that and you realize that, you realize how lucky you are to be a part of it. And it's a real privilege. I love it. I really love it. It's so insane. You don't know what you're going to do. Bonnie Tyler's coming on tomorrow to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart.
That's my era as well.
I know. I mean, you
might live well, or not, or miming?
Live.
Of course it's ITV. It's live.
And it's Bonnie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I might as well retire after that tomorrow. There's no point. It's not getting better.
I do watch it. And for the listeners, and this is me talking to you, I don't think they realise how good people like you are at your job. Because a lot of these, especially at the rugby, it's not on the what they call them, the prompts. What are the presidents and the
prompts? Auto-cue, yes. Yeah. So the words auto-cue. Come up on the screen.
There is sometimes, as in if you're in the big studio, but if you're pitch side or if you're doing that stuff, it is off the cuff. Whilst you've got a producer in your ear, whilst you're trying to get the devil of the detail and all these things, it is a tough, tough gig.
I do think there has to be something a little bit wrong with you to do it. I mean, you're right. Pitch side, I'd have split ears. So I have earpieces in one ear. I'd have all my guests and what they're talking about, the interviews with the coaches and any little VTs. So any videotape interviews, things like that, go in one ear. The other one is the gallery. The gallery is the PA. And they're the one who's going, okay, ad break in 10, 9, 8, 7. And you have to finish saying whatever you're saying on zero. You've got the producer going, yeah, wrap that up. Oh, just Craig, what are you doing? What, there's something, what? Ask him that. Oh, hurry up. And you have a director going, Craig, lovely shots now. I'm giving you shots now of Owen Farrell punching someone in the face. Or whatever it might be. So you get so used to that. When they don't talk, you're like, what's going on?
Mm.
And I want to hear people discussing their dinner plans in the background. It's a huge number of stimuli in your brain. And then you have to sound like everything's kind of calm. And you get so used to it that you rely on the noise and the you don't want silence anymore. But if I go to a restaurant now, I'm like my wife be talking to me, but I'm listening to a conversation over another table as well. You're always absorbing stuff. So it's really bad for you. But it is kind of crazy. It's a very odd job. I was thinking that this morning. We're about to go live for this morning. I was thinking, I don't know many million people are watching this. And I'm with Josie Gibson, who's an absolute dote. And she's a bit nervy. And I'm looking at her going, why am I not nervous? What's wrong with me? Why is this so normal? This feels like the most, actually, I would say in a live TV studio, it's where I'm at my calmest.
Really?
And most peaceful space.
Mm.
It's really weird.
Prepared. Weird. Born for it.
I mean, I don't prep for this morning because you've got experts and people telling stories. So you do a lot of listening. Actually, presenting, the thing you should be really good at is listening.
Mm.
You shouldn't really write out lists of questions. You should always be like the chat we're having now. We're just chatting, right? So Parkinson was always so good, wasn't he? He just listened. And so you just do a lot of listening and chatting and filling the gaps. And it's weird, though. But it shouldn't be a calm place. But it really is. It's really weird. I've never really figured that out.
All the greats that I've listened to, listen being the key word in all this. That's what they say the art of conversation and being best at is listening. And that's what I'm trying to get used to, is not asking questions, having the conversation, but absorbing what the guests are saying. And this is kind of all new. And had a guy called Gordon Smart was in here. Really, really smart guy. Loads of stories. Not that you need to deliver a load of stories, but we were talking about media and the way that media is now. And he used to work at The Sun in the entertainment space and became friends with all these celebrities and was like an insider and like just crazy stories about Noel, Liam Gallagher, the main man from Coldplay, Vinnie Jones, right. Like these parties and stuff like that. And I was asking a bit of advice. I was like, you know, I'm in this media space, like doing a podcast, like how to get it to take off. And he's like, you've got to ask the hard questions that you know that are going to get the clicks or get the interaction. And it was like, okay, I thought that. Went away, I asked him a couple of questions as well. And you know, the ones that come out on Instagram Reels or TikTok, yeah. The big questions. I was like, that ain't me.
Yeah, out of context.
Yeah, out of the blue. Mm. As in, I understand that is the shift in media and it's kind of trying to get a headline and then someone editorializes it with that headline, but that isn't me. So I think I'm trying to find this kind of space of comfort of listening conversation. And what the content is. Like, do you split the podcast up into two bits and therefore you can double revenue if you do make revenue doing podcasts? So still learning, but listening is the key part for me.
But the problem now is you don't get space to learn. So when I started off, you were sent off to local radio. I went to college here in London where I studied journalism. Quite a prestigious college at the time. And the BBC used to come in and take people from it. But they didn't put you straight on Radio 4 or 5 Live. You went to, like, I went to the regions. I went to Norfolk and then I went to Suffolk. And you're doing stories about turnip prices and sugar beet. And then you work your way through and you learn. You make a load of mistakes. You don't get sued because no one's listening. It's all fine. You learn. But now it's like, boom, propelled. And you say something controversial or do something controversial and suddenly boom, everyone's talking about you and you're a star. And there's no space to learn or no space to make mistakes. And it's high jeopardy now, isn't it? Because before, like BBC Radio Suffolk, I could have said something all those years ago. No one's hearing that outside of Suffolk. Mm. But now it's just whew, around the world. I mean, yesterday morning, I accidentally gave a duck an orgasm. It happens. I put that on my Instagram because I know somebody was going to put that on their Instagram, right? So I said, I'll take control of it. I'll lean into this, as they say, and I'll put this on my Instagram. I like, you don't know what's going to happen. I think it's slightly risky. There's a duck. Duck's happy. Duck had a great time.
It looked very happy. You sent me the video and it probably as happy as it could have been at any moment.
Yeah, duck had a great, great time. And we all had a good time. We're all friends. It's all fine. But you don't know how that's going to be taken. And there's an element of fear now. You're just like, oh, like, where does that go? Like, it could just, I made a duck noise. I didn't mean to, it's just, but that could just travel around the world, this whole thing. And next thing you're the guy who wanked off a duck. It's like, oh God, are people just going to laugh at it? It's so scary. It's so scary. But sometimes you're left with no choice. You have to go, I should better, someone else is going to do it. I might as well just do it myself. At least I can monitor it, you know? So there's no space for mistakes, no space for learning anymore. You have to be very, very careful. But if you're too careful, then whatever you're doing is boring. You don't want your podcast to be boring, Jim. You want it to be interesting. You want it to be kind of shocking at times. You want to do all those things. But so it's high risk and high reward, I guess. But it's I think it's a really difficult space. And people say it's brilliant media now because anyone can get into it. But the processes have all disappeared. Mm. It's like flash, poof. You know, you're a media star. You're a journalist now.
Yeah.
You know, you don't do any of the work to get there,
mm.
which I don't think is great.
With your kids, and I'm going through this process, they live their life around social media, like they're consuming, like my lads on YouTube Shorts looking at basketball stuff, doesn't want to read. And I'm like, mate, you need to read, you need to write, like this is the way forward. And then I'm like, is it the way forward? You know, or is that me thinking that that is the way forward because it's the opposite of kind of what you're doing? Like these kids now, and the media analogy is really interesting that they can jump into media by doing some TikTok dancing and then become a social media influence that has such cultural clout now ahead of someone that can read 10 books a week. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, how are you with your kids? Are you in it, being in the media and understanding old school media, journalism, reading, writing, and then now seeing this new age stuff?
I'm not in control of it, actually. None of us are. We think we are as parents. We're not in control of it. My eldest son is quite an academic. He's studying history in Trinity College, and he loves to read.
Great.
Oh, it's great. It's great. It's my degrees in history. He's studying history. He's far smarter than me. But he loves to read. He reads. All the kids read, actually.
That's great.
They all read, but there's too much phone action.
Mm.
There's too much phone action. Yeah, the consumption of things, 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. That's the limit. To sit down for watch a movie for an hour and 40 with the family is difficult now because the kids are used to shorter hits.
Mm.
I don't love that. I don't like the way social lives are played out over Snap. I hate that. I mean, this is the common thing, isn't it? You know, if someone didn't call me, but they've snapped someone else. They haven't got back to my Snap. It's like, oh my God, the pressures of it all. But yeah, I think you're right in that. Maybe our way is just not relevant anymore. It's never going to be again.
Mm. I think it's tougher on the kids now. Life is easier now because you can get everything, Amazon, Deliveroo, all these things. But I think socially, you don't need to share. How many kids have you got?
Four.
Yeah. Oh, we've gone through this before because we've got four kids each and we like dogs.
Yeah.
But
Boxer dogs specifically.
We'll get on to boxer dogs. Yes. I'd love to talk to you. Stop sending me pictures of dogs because
let's get more of them.
Yeah. I love dogs.
I love them so much.
But the way that life is now, it does seem tougher for kids.
Yeah.
And with, like, we're away with work the whole time as well. And it's that balance of, is it good for your kids to see your dad out working all the time and earn a living and having that ambition because then that rubs off on them? Or I'm constantly battling, like, I need to be at home more. Then when I'm at home, I'm thinking, well, like this weekend, I was meant to be commentating on La Rochelle Saracens and Glasgow the night before. I was like, no, I'm having the weekend off, and then I'm like, I should be working. Like, constant battle with myself, but I think that's deep-rooted.
I think that's just with you, though. I don't think your kids are spotting that.
Mm.
And the problem with that is, because I go through this as well, we work weekends all the time, Jim, you and I, right? So you're like, oh, God, I need to be around for the kids. But then, because I took the weekend off too, I did the Leinster game Friday night, and I was watching La Rochelle game, thinking I should be in studio. But I have it on, and I'm there. I'm at work. And I'm not really present in the house.
Yeah.
Because half my brain's gone, I should be over there doing that, really. I should be over there doing that. So the only way to do it is to cut it off and just not watch it. If my biggest guilt thing from my parenting is it's not being present.
Mm.
I find it very hard.
Creatives are hard like that, though, isn't it? If you are creative
awful.
And you're in that space.
Yeah. Awful. And I used to find even when the kids were small and like trying to play Lego with them or dolls or whatever it was, I'd be like, yeah, but why don't you do this? It's like, no, don't. Just do their game.
Mm.
They don't want your advice. And then they go, no, I'm okay. I'm going to play Barbie on my own. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
I had such big plans for Ken and Barbie. You know, that's the biggest learning. But I think you're right. I think the creative brain, which you have, which I have, is look, it's both a gift and a curse. It really is, because there's no cam time. There's very little cam time, unless you're in a live TV studio, because that's when your brain's working at its absolute optimum. That's when your brain is made for that space. But it's not made for a kind of quiet space sitting at home. That's why, I bet you cook, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I cook.
Something to do. Mm.
Something to do. I have the number of half-finished jobs around the half-sanded door, half-painted thing, actually, I'd never have power hose anything, because power hosing lives. What a great choice. But yeah, it's horrible. Sometimes I really envy cam people. Do you?
I say that. So one of my mates, I've spoke about him loads, works in a factory, isn't for one thing of nothing, has no desire to go to Dubai, to go skiing, to go traveling around America, to go to India and go to these iconic places, wherever it is in Australia, China. He didn't want to travel. He is the most content man. Gets in his car, Ford Mondeo, big shout out to Ford Mondeo, love them.
Yeah, nice.
Robust as anything. Yeah. Robust, he's under 180,000 miles without even a flicker. Chat to him about nothing. He's got no interest in anything. Watches a bit of football at the weekend. His highlight is a takeaway, repeat, and he'll go to Tenerife or Benidorm once a year. And there's a part of me that I'm jealous that I'm not that content.
What do you think of your life?
Madness. It's like, I don't know how, London. So I live in the Midlands. It's like, London's an hour away. Never. I said, London, nah, no interest. Mate, London's all going on. It's all kicking off. Like, no. And there was one part of me that was like, fuck, he ain't lived. He hasn't lived, you know, in my opinion. But there's another part to me where I'm like, that must be so, and he's happy. Mm-hmm. Like, he genuinely is happy. And it's like, well, I wish I went home from work, or whatever work is, to sit on the sofa and put TV. I just cannot. I can't sit down at all. And it drives my wife crazy. But we know, like, that's who I am. Like, it's, I have to do something. The weekend, I'm off. I'm not. Like, anything. Everything and anything.
Okay, I'm going to ask you some questions.
All right, you can ask me.
Do you mind?
Please.
Could you create your own Excel spreadsheet?
Could I?
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
How are you, say, like folding napkins, folding clothes, folding that kind of thing? Is that something you could kind of do?
A little.
If I was to say to you right now, Jim, in 4 days, would you be available at 3 o'clock?
No idea.
Right. And if I was to say to you, I need to get you over to La Rochelle next week, but I need to get you back to Glasgow, and then would you could be down in London 2 days after that? Do you feel physically ill at the thought of planning that?
Yes, I do. And that is the bane of my life.
So I find that all this very relatable, because that's how I feel about stuff. And there's a definite kind of there's ADD and ADHD, right? And situation there. And they're all landmark moments. They're landmark things, textbook things that you struggle with. Very basic things. It's actually not running another place hyperactive.
Mm.
It's really basic organizational things that you struggle with and I struggle with. And creative people tend to struggle with this stuff. And once you acknowledge it and recognize it, which I'm actually only in the process of doing now at 52 years of age.
Are you 52?
I'm 52.
Bloody hell, you look good. Oh, man, and you know it. You look good for 52. Sorry.
I feel okay. It's like, because it's so stressful.
Mm.
And people don't understand when they go, you know, can you do this? Can you do that? And you're like, I don't know. I don't even, like, tomorrow afternoon, can you do something? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
The stress of trying to plan. I don't even know how we get onto this. Two people with attention deficit disorder trying to have a conversation is ridiculous.
But that, when them things happen, and I'm like, right, I can't do that now. But all I'm thinking about is that at that moment. We were talking about being present, weren't we? Like that.
Yeah. That's what we're talking about, being present. So, it's very hard. It's very, very hard.
Mm.
And I don't know. I still don't know how to do it.
Mm.
And I hate it. And then you're going, right, today I'm going to be present with the kids. And you're sitting there going, yeah, just be present. Mm. Just this is me being present. And then you're overthinking about being present and you go, actually, I don't know how to be. Is this being present? Whereas you look at really chilled out people like your Mondeo pal, he's just like, oh, he's this there. He's just melted into the scene around him.
Yeah. No social media. Exactly. And maybe that's what it is. Like one of the things at home now, I have to put my phone in the drawer in a different room. I know these are simple things that people talk about all the time. Because if I'm at home, if I'm doing something, if I'm sat talking to the wife and I see a message pop up, all I'm thinking about is that message. I'm not even listening to what. So you imagine she's fucking going out of mind. So I've put a few things in place, and we were chatting as well about training. Like training's a big thing for me, like post rugby as well. But that gives me a little bit of clarity. But and I suppose these things are what accumulate that can make people successful as well. This and you know, you listen. I watched Elon Musk documentary. And you talk about, he's got Asperger's, hasn't he? Like, it's all over the place. Yeah. We're talking about the most gifted human being maybe ever to have been on the planet. And then you look at other stuff around, like, dyslexia and ADHD and all these other kind of disorders or whatever, that some of the most successful people, however you define success, creative in their space, in their industry, have something that is away from the norm. So I'm trying to embrace...
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
It's your superpower, isn't it? You know, if you've lived with it for that long, it's your superpower and it allows you, and it's pointed you in the direction of the things you do. Because I do think we just follow a natural path of we tend to follow a natural path of the things we're good at and the things that suit our personalities. So kind of people like you and I end up doing jobs like you and I do. When I was a very young kid, I don't know how old I was, but my mother and father spotted something in me that wasn't quite normal. And they brought me to the GP, you know, the local GP, Dr. Mead. And he's like, essentially your son's a little bit bats. And they prescribed some medication and my mother wouldn't give it to me. She said, we'll just leave him. So that was good enough back then. It'll be good enough now. But some people have other skills, but would love to have a creative side to them. You know what I mean? You can't have everything. It all balances out, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, a bit of calm be lovely, wouldn't it?
Mm.
A bit of calm. Jeez, what I do for a bit of head calm sometimes.
Whatever calm means. One thing, and we're going to talk about dogs now, that gives me, or it did, and you know, I had a boxer. We're both lovers of boxer dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And I had my boxer dog for 12 years. 12 years good age, because he was riddled. He was... buggered. And he had a double knee op, ACL reconstruction when he was 4. So when he was young, his knees blew out, but he lasted till 12. And when I had to put him down, the saddest day, I'm not a big cry. Sometimes I cry at a movie. I cried at A Star Is Born, weirdly. And Maverick as well, Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah, of course you do.
Oh, did you as well?
I cry at DIY SOS.
Yeah, I do.
I probably cry every day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, I'm a crier then, because I've just said I'm not a crier.
Yeah, but we are a crier.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, but don't fight it.
Yeah.
I just say as well on this, I'm sorry, we're going off a little bit here, but like it's such a amazing emotion to be upset over something that makes you feel like that, right?
It's not real.
But it doesn't matter. It's designed. Really clever people have written a thing, right? A storyline, and they've cast certain people and put music to it to make you cry. It doesn't mean that you're softy, you're crying. It just means that the movie is working, the TV show is working. When Nick Knowles kind of has to wipe a tear at the end of DIY SOS, that's designed to make us cry. Go with it. Have a cry.
Yeah.
It feels all right. It's a brilliant emotion to have.
It is.
I don't mind it. I'm okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. I think it's cathartic as well. How do we get to cry? Dogs.
Yeah,
but
dogs.
But that's a different kind of cry. Oh, that's too heartbreaking.
That was like a deep, deep cry.
Did he get put down?
Had to get him put down.
Did you hold him? Did you hold him?
Yeah. I was gone.
Oh, you're gone. You're going to go.
No. I'm okay now. When it took me about a year to get it. I didn't realise. I was like, it's a dog, Brucey, 12, good age. When I got him put down, my word, I was like bawling. I couldn't believe it.
Of course you were.
Had to walk out. I'm not like a cuddly person or whatever.
No, you're a really awkward hugger, actually.
Yeah.
I know. I remember that when I hugged you outside, I was like, oh, this is really awful.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, my wife finds that as well. I'm not like a.
I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah. She tried to hug me after, and I was like, I can't. I could faint here. I'm crying that much. I could hit the floor. But boxers are a special dog, aren't they?
They're not even the same animal as most dogs. So we've two at the moment. Rigby, who's just Craig holds up phone of picture of Rigby, my old, oh God, he's so beautiful.
Is Rigby still here?
Yeah.
He looks old.
Why have you heard?
No, great beard. He's got a great grey beard.
I know, but have you heard and heard anything? He's still all right, isn't he?
Yeah,
My wife hasn't called you to say don't tell. No, he's fine. He's 9 though.
Oh, okay.
Shit. I hate that. Mm. People go, how old is he? It doesn't matter how old he is. Because I know 12 and a boxer. But I adore him. He has ACL problems. So you know what he does? He comes along and sits beside me in the sofa. He comes over and he backs up and puts his bum beside me. And then the two legs pop up. Back legs straight. And he's like that. And he sits beside me. How are you? And then we've Hank, who's the most beautiful white boxer, giant guy. They give you so much joy.
Mm.
They give you, because they're so loving. Because we just love being loved, humans, don't we? We're complete narcissists, particularly us lot, creative lot. So dogs really fulfill that role very, very well. But boxers in particular.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're amazing animals. We've shared a lot of boxer stories, haven't we, Jim, watching matches?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, dogs are the greatest gift. Like boxers, I feel bad at Odie calling out the dog. We've got a miniature schnauzer. It ain't a dog. Mm. Not really a dog.
Maggie Alfonsi has a couple of those, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, they're not dogs. Maggie, they're not dogs.
No.
It's not even a schnauzer, it's a miniature schnauzer.
All right, yeah. Why did you not go boxer again?
Wife was like, look, you're away. We've got 4 kids at home. Like, the Bruce the dog used to eat socks, slippers, pants. So we had to, like, take him to get emergency surgery because he'd eaten some of the kids' pants and the missus' thongs and stuff like that, the bloody wiry thongs. So she's not allowed thongs anymore. She has to get big granny pants. So the dogs don't eat them. That's her excuse. But
I love it when they've got something in their mouth, just a corner, and they're going,
yeah.
And then you start pulling, and it's, like, still going. Like, oh, my God, how far down? Are you shitting this the same time as I'm pulling it out?
Oh.
There's so much material here.
Oh, I used to have to pop his anal glands as well.
That's commitment. Disgusting.
That's commitment. Bloody fortune, 80 quid. I was like, how do you do these? What is this smell? And they're like, right, you need to get your fucking... I was like, right, real man. Fucking get. You could do it on the outside, though. I didn't realise that. So I went on the inside. He's screaming. I'm screaming. The smell. But that's love.
That's love.
That is love.
Yeah, but hey... If your boxer dog had opposable thumbs, he'd do your anal gland. You know he would.
Yes, he would.
Because they do anything for you.
Yeah, I'm going to get a boxer again.
Yeah, do.
Soon.
Do.
Yeah, they look great riding shotgun as well, don't they? You know, so if you do want a bit on the gram or TikTok, not that you should be driving on your phone, but if someone snaps a picture.
I'm not allowed to put the boxers up on Insta. My wife won't let it.
Why?
Because she doesn't want, you know, what if someone steals them?
You've got double glazed windows and a security
triple.
Door.
I've triple.
There you go. They're not.
I work for them, so I've triple. Double glazed. You're not getting through those bad boys. God. Everything would be better. When I started in BBC Radio Suffolk, there was a very cool producer there, a very posh guy, and he had a boxer and he used to bring it to work. And I'd just sit on the floor with his dog all day. Fantastic.
Yeah.
You should get one in here. Just get there. Every company should have. I was reading a thing yesterday that there's a some police force in Washington or something have a pet rabbit, and they have this rabbit in the station. And when the cops come in after a really hard day or shooting, whatever, they all just go and spend have some rabbit time.
Have some rabbit time.
Sit down with the rabbits. A lot to be said for it.
Well, you were milking a duck yesterday.
I was milking a duck. That's so weird.
I know. What's a phrase? It looked like it was being milked. I don't. Anyway, if they can follow your Instagram.
But you know, I'll tell you what was weird about it. Craig A. Doyle is the Instagram. Can't get the numbers up, yeah?
Yeah.
Or
you can buy them from Indonesia, like Haskell told me. All the lads have bought them. Yeah, it's completely butchered. Don't do that. I bought 20,000 from Indonesia and it's fucked the algorithm.
It has. What does that even mean? I don't even know.
Well, it means it's almost like it wants feeding again. So you've bought them for, I think I spent maybe 800 quid.
What?
Like Matt Dawson was all over me to get it. There was loads of people on it. You look at the interactions.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll see people on social media, have they got like 200 or 500,000 followers? And they've only got 3 likes. Indonesia. Yeah, don't do it. And then obviously it knows that it wants to keep getting fed.
All right.
So if you don't keep feeding it, it's not giving you any output. So it doesn't show up your pictures on.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's the dirty world, the murky world of social media.
So these are all robots. They're not real people.
I don't know whether they're robots. They're called like click farms.
Cooking
and then
books.
Now you can look into it. So that's why the insights and algorithms, you can go on your insights and
go
on mine. It says I've got 3,000. Maybe it might be 5 or 10 in Indonesia. So I've got a big following over there.
Big over there.
So calling out James Haskell, I think that's what he's done.
What's this podcast about?
Anything and everything.
Is that
it is, yeah. So
yeah.
I think it's just good people who are doing great things in life and having a conversation and seeing where they go. Like, I listen to podcasts in America, and it's like I listen to sports podcasts Australia. Mm. And I don't know whether culturally we're just very, there always seems to be like, there needs to be a reason behind doing something, like, yeah, as in a much bigger reason to do it, as opposed to just not, yeah, two legends, a legend in your, you,
where,
know,
where's the legend? As,
you know, just good people, yeah, just having a, yeah, chat, no, and just getting to know, yeah, people. Yeah, and, yeah, I genuinely love doing it. It's, mm, not to make money. Like, when people come over, I sort their travel, there's a little bit of sponsorship that comes in, but I've not done it and thought, you know what? Yeah. I'm going to launch the Big Gym Show because I want to make a shitload of money. That's, yeah, not what I thought. I thought, how cool is it to invite people to the studio
for a chat
in London, just to chat, yeah, about anything?
I like it.
It's good. But,
yeah,
we can talk about things.
Okay.
Like, as in that, well, we've bloody sold £1 million worth of windows.
Yeah, we sold a lot of windows.
So we've sold that.
I have my worst ever. Do you want to know really bad stuff?
Mm.
I'm going to tell you about, and I never really got over it. I have done, but it took me a long time. The BBC, to go back to the start of that story, when I was, so I was the BBC and I did Tomorrow's World and I did the holiday program. And then I went, and this kind of ties in the first part of this pod, actually, because it brings in windows,
yep,
career, and not being ready for media jobs. And the BBC, I left the holiday program to do sport, and they had me presenting Grandstand. Now, my teacher in school, the careers teacher, when I was like in that kind of fourth year, you know, and they said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to present Grandstand. I used to love Grandstand. To sit down Saturday afternoon, just watch it all day. Loved it. Didn't care what sport was on. It was just really good quality, bro. I loved it. I want to present Grandstand. They went, yeah, okay. So what do you do? Work experience? I said, well, I want to go to RTE or Irish Television or somewhere and just be involved in a sports show. And they help sort it out. So they put me with a tea marketing company, and I was with a salesman for a week. Because they went, you're never going to be in broadcasting. It ain't going to happen. It was very quiet. I remember even in that year having to read an essay out in class, and I cried because I didn't want to read it out. So I wouldn't say boo to a goose. I was very, very quiet. So the day I presented Grandstand, and it gets better than that, I was a Man United fan all my life. And Brian Robson was, I had posters of him. My first guest on Grandstand, Brian Robson.
No way.
I'm tying in a lot of elements here because I'm going to bring, yes, in the crying thing here in a second. So I'm sitting there going, I'm about to present Grandstand. Fuck you. Every single person who said I'd never do this. Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. I'm doing it. I'm doing it.
I remember.
Do you remember all that? And I'm looking at Brian Robson, and guess what happens? The tears start. I'm like, I'm starting to cry because I can't believe this is actually happening.
How old are you, roughly?
Oh, I'm old enough to know better. I'm old. I've been, like, at this stage, it's like,
end, you know, this is cup final.
It's end of first lap of a media career here, you know. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, put it this way. College, 3 years in BBC, radio, 3 or 4 years in BBC radio as a reporter, then a producer. A year in kind of kids TV. 3 years Tomorrow's World, 7 years holiday program, and that's where I'm. So there's many years, okay? So I'm 30s. I did it. And then they pulled Grandstand after about 6 months. But they sent me to the Olympics, to the Athens Olympics. And I wasn't ready for it, the scale of it. I don't know if you've ever been to an Olympics. I mean, you probably went to some of the London events. Mm. You can't imagine the size of this thing. You just, whatever your sport is, if you're into sport, if you're listening, whatever your sport is, imagine just like hundreds of versions of that happening all day, every day for 16 days. It's impossible to get your head around the scale of it. And nearly everybody competing is the best at it from their country. It's huge.
Mm.
And to study for it and get ready for it, I just couldn't. I was so overwhelmed by the information. I wish I knew then what I know now about my brain and how it works. And I couldn't cope. But I couldn't cope live on television. And I had to host coverage, live coverage during the day, and then do a highlight show with Claire Balding every night. Claire Balding is a magnificent broadcaster. She's brilliant and was just sailing through this, and I was in absolute crisis. I couldn't cope with it. It was too much information overload. It was awful. It was pure awful.
Mm.
And of course, the public copped onto this pretty quickly, and I was getting slagged off. And then the journos and sports writers in the papers started at me. And I was getting stuff from back home, and they were saying really nasty.
What was the thing? Were you stammering? Were you?
No, it was just terrible. Just terrible. Just
delivery names. What was
just
it?
Just everything. I didn't have a clue. It was too big for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It was too big. I wasn't ready. Getting names wrong. Didn't understand anything. Trying to be funny, not funny, to cover up your. I was all over the place. all over the place. And Claire's just, I'm looking at her going, I'll never be like that. She's so good. And there was a bit of a time difference. We'd come off air at midnight, one, whatever. I'd go to the hotel, the rooftop bar. I would drink as much as I could possibly consume. I'd go to my room. I'd bawl my eyes out. I'd get up and do it all the next day for 16 days. It was fucking torture. Mm. It's as close as I've ever got, I think, to some kind of breakdown. I thought I was going to have a breakdown because I knew the stuff that was coming from home. People were telling me and I could see it, you know, papers lying around the place. It was so bad. A Labour politician tabled a question in the Parliament saying, is Craig Doyle suitable to be on the national broadcaster during such an important event in Ireland? And that all made the papers. The front page of the Sunday Independent, I've never forgiven them. The front page of the Sunday Independent at home. And I just think of my poor old dad who's no longer with us. But the front page said, Doyle hated in Britain.
No, it didn't.
Front page of a Sunday broadsheet newspaper, Craig Doyle hated in Britain. Now, it wasn't the main story, but it was on the front page of it. It was so embarrassing. It was so awful and so embarrassing. I came home. We had two kids. We were going to Sardinia to, where's that place? Austin has the training. There's the rugby training.
The legend thing. Stuff.
The legend stuff. We're going there. Forte Village, right? Mm. And of course, I'm like jumpy. I'm all over the place. You know, this horrible thing's happened. I'm mortified because when that happens to you and you're not used to it, you think everyone is looking and laughing at you. I came home. I shaved my head. I went full Britney Spears. Full Britney Spears. I had to get away from that person that was on. And I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm actually going to go and I'm going to do a master's in history. I'm going to become a history professor. That was my kind of plan. We went over to Sardinia. I remember meeting Fiona Bruce at this place, quite a posh place. And she's like, oh, Craig, how are you? Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah. But did you read all that stuff? I mean, and I just, like a crazy man. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen her since. It's a long, long time ago, obviously. But it was so destructive and awful. I said, like, I'll never do that again. I'm out of this business. And then there was a day at the BBC for all the presenters and all the talent. And they had them all in a huge room, loads and loads of people. And all the bosses were up there talking. It was like, this is great. And we're going to, I remember sitting with Manish. Manish was just, his star was just rising. I'm like, oh my God, this is great. And halfway through it, they had a coffee break. And the one of the bosses came over to me and said, just let you know, we're not renewing your contract. And I went stupidly and sat in the room for the rest of this thing going, why am I even here? It was so bad. I was like, how am I going to feed the kids? It was so awful. It was so awful. And I swore to myself, I will never, ever allow that happen again. And I went, they ended up having me doing bits and bobs and they had me doing horse racing. I said, I'm not doing horse racing anymore for you because I don't know enough about it. Mm. I'm not doing anything I don't know anything about. And they said, we'd like you to do triathlon. I said, okay, because I had a bit of a contract to run out. So I joined a triathlon club and I ended up doing triathlon and actually competing in it. And I said, I'll never do anything unless I know about it again. So it was the biggest life lesson I had. But my God, it took years to get over it. And I ended up doing some chat shows in Ireland that were a complete disaster. And I remember having to go and do a press day after one of them. It was really bad, the show. And we pulled it after 5 episodes. And we decided to rework it and go again a month later. And all these journals there. And I went, hi, all, look, the show's shit. Any questions? They're like, well, you know, I can't, you know, you can't criticize it more than that. I got into terrible trouble for that. But yeah, I just kind of thought I'm going to face things up from now on. That was the biggest learning curve I ever had. I thought I was like the greatest guy in the world. I'm living the dream, presenting this show, and then phew, taken away from you. I don't know how I got to this bit.
Well,
I obviously felt the need to offload it to you, Jim. Is it your kind eye? It's your kind eyes.
That's what happens in here. But I think it was about when we were talking about crying. You know, where it's overlaid with music.
Yeah, yes.
This segment here, overlaid with music in slow.
Yeah,
we're all going to be crying.
Yeah, I think so.
Because it's like it's hitting rock bottom.
Yeah.
To go back up again.
Yeah.
That's the story of redemption. You know, failure and then success.
Yeah.
Even my voice there, that could be voiced over with some really cool music on TikTok. Maybe sped up a little bit because it's longer than 30 seconds, so they might not consume it. So thank you for that.
I can help you with the middle part in case it dies off, and I'll use the buttery voice. Would that help?
Yes.
10 seconds.
We'll do that.
I remember looking myself in the mirror, my two beautiful children at home, and thinking, never mind feeding them, housing them, how can they ever be proud of their father again?
That is amazing. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's good to share.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We'll get on to some headlines now.
Okay.
Let's start with this, because I put a tweet out around the Isle of Man TT.
Yeah.
That's what I first remember you from. Okay. I don't remember all the drama that we've just gone through then. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the windows. I remember the MotoGP, but also the Isle of Man TT. Like, just, I found myself even during COVID watching this. I've got a motorbike, I've got Harley Davidson that I drive very slowly. Mm. Look cool as shit on it, but I drive slowly. I'm not a rider. And I look at these.
There's so much of you though, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I fell off, I mean, it's just.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's big.
They're closing the northbound and southbound lanes if you fall off. There's so much of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a feeling of feeling free and freedom. Mm. You talk about mindset and you talk about different humans. That Isle of Man TT, and I tweeted about it, I shouldn't have done, I've passed judgment on something that I know nothing about. Six people died in the last one. Mm-hmm. They're racing motorbikes doing 200 plus miles an hour on bloody roads where there's people there, can signpost, there's pubs.
There's curbs, there's potholes, there's lampposts, there's walls.
That, and I watch sports. Mm-hmm. I love UFC, I love boxing. I know there's all these different things around NFL and rugby and the dangers and stuff like that. You show me something more dangerous than the Isle of Man TT, and I'm telling you now, there ain't. From my opinion, that is one of the craziest things on this earth that I have watched. What is that like working at? How are you with all that?
I spent 10 years.
Yeah.
I'd go over every year for a few weeks. I covered British superbikes for a while, so I enjoyed the biking. They're quite like the rugby community, actually. They're very interested in their sport. They all know each other. It's a tight community. And when you're in, you feel very special to be part of it. The Isle of Man TT is a race around the mountain. It's 32 plus miles. It's done in about 17 minutes. It's insane.
And it's not straight, obviously.
It's not straight. So picture a series of A roads, wherever you live, wherever you're listening. And we go for a nice Sunday drive. Picture big curves and jumps and potholes and walls. And that's the race course. There are very few parts of it that are just long, long stretches. There are long stretches where they're going way over 200 miles an hour. It's so incredibly dangerous. But to ride it, you have to be so incredibly focused. So they're not there going, way, you know, they're not doing that. They are laser focused, laser, laser focused. The start of the race is on the Glencutchery Road, in front of this grandstand that's always there. This has been going on for a long, long time, this race, for 100 years. They go through down a dip down Glencutchery Road. They go down through Ninian's Cross and up into Bray Hill. I would say within about 3 to 4 seconds, they're doing about 160 miles an hour. There's a guy called Brian who has a house halfway up Bray Hill. And I would sit in his front garden just behind his wall to watch them go by. So they pass by maybe 4 feet from me. It takes about 5 or 6 bikes to go by before you can see them. Do you understand what I'm saying? The concept of that. They're going so fast, your eyes can't send the message to your brain to acknowledge a motorbike has gone by. They're going by that quickly. You cannot take a photograph of them going by. It's just a streak. It's so incredibly quick. They readjust as they hit the bottom of Ninian's Cross. There's a little section on the right-hand side where the bike bottoms out and you get a little spark. So it flies down on the right-hand side. It goes, and it readjusts over to the left by maybe 10 feet to the left side of the road. It's like the Matrix. You don't see the move. It just goes, doo-doo-sh. It's so bonkers. It's so, so bonkers, but they're so skilled. John McGuinness, King of the Mountain, greatest TT rider of all time. The guy's a little bit overweight now, but he rides a bike like no one I've ever seen before. He is incredible. The crashes are so catastrophic. I can't even describe how some people die out there. But you know, when they line up 86 riders, you know every year on average, 3 are going to die. 86 people, and you're looking at them go off. Every year, every single race, I stood at the start line and would see every single rider off. I just watched them all go. It just became a thing. because I knew I'd have to report on one of their deaths. And I just felt, because it was the ITV show was the only show it was on, I knew I'd have to report their death. And I knew it was really important to their family to get that right. And I knew I had to see them at the start of the day to be able to do that with any credibility. But I it became so emotional, I had to stop doing it because people I knew started dying.
Mm.
And I remember a guy called Shuey dying, and I found that very hard to deal with. And you'd often know before his family knew, because I get it on my little radio, because it's not like they're trying to do it live, but it's nearly impossible because the race course goes all the way around a mountain. And you'd hear, you know, X has died, and I'm in the paddock, and I'm looking at his wife and his kids, his team, and I'm like, I know your husband's dead. I know he's up there in pieces, up on that hill. And you don't know yet. And I hated that. I thought, fucking cheek of me knowing that.
Mm.
I shouldn't know that. There were so many elements to it that felt so, so wrong. But you then talk to the riders about it. And they go, well, what else are we meant to do? We don't know anything else. I'd rather die up on that mountain than not be able to do this. Because it's the greatest feeling I get in my life. And if I don't do it, I don't want to be alive. Now, for you and I to understand that is very, very difficult. For most of the population to understand, that's very, very difficult. But I learned to respect that that was their view and that was their opinion. And this was one place in the world where they are allowed to do that. You know, and that's just the way it is.
Mm.
But, oh my word, it's the skill level's huge.
But well, I should have said that, but I wanted you to explain it in the way in which you just have, getting goosebumps listening to that. Because it's easy to put something out on Twitter when it's happening, talking about how dangerous, which is an obvious statement to make. But then watching more and more of it, and I was watching more because I knew we were going to chat and I wanted to chat to you about it. The deep-rooted love for, if you call it a sport or an event, like you said, that's what they'd rather die there than anywhere else. It's like that's them, that's who they are, it's what they are. Like the Dunlop family, which has got deep-rooted history, probably the most famous family. How many people have they lost?
Robert died. Joey died. William died. Robert's son, William. Yeah.
If one dying or two dying isn't enough to put you off, then you know that.
But it's in their blood.
There you go.
And we've, look, I know people won't agree, but we've no right to judge that.
No, absolutely right.
We've no right to judge that. There are lots of people doing lots of things in life that you mightn't understand. And do I understand it? No. Do I respect their decision to feel like that? I 100% do. When you're there, behind the grandstand on the Glencutchery Road, you have the factory teams. You have your Hondas, you have your Suzukis, you have Triumph, whatever. Big, big trucks. And then you have the next level, which is a slightly smaller truck, maybe someone with a few quid and a sponsor. And then it goes all the way down into a park. So picture main road, which is the start line, and then a car park where the big trucks are. And then it goes down into a park, which for most of the year is a park. People kicking a football around, having picnics, whatever they're doing. But then that park, at the very bottom of it, is a guy in a tent with his mate and a motorbike. And he's also racing on that race course with Michael Dunlop, or John McGuinness, or Bruce Anstey, some of the greatest road racers of all time. Of all time. This guy does that for 2 weeks, and then he goes back to his life. And he will live for the next time when he gets to do that. In footballing terms, you're a football fan, you pay for your Sunday team, but once a year, you get to play with Messi. You get to go into the same stadium, the same pitch as Lionel Messi and play football with him. Mm. That's what they're doing. Do we have a right to take that dream away from them?
No, we don't.
We don't. No. I'm sorry.
No.
And if you understand sport and you understand passion, you'll understand that.
Mm.
And it's hard to get your head around. It really is. If their families understand that, if their widows understand that, we have to understand it.
Yeah.
You know? And I've raved about this all the time, Jim, but I've lived it. I've been there with these people.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to talk to you about it, because for anyone who doesn't know or hasn't seen what we're talking about, YouTube, that's as close as you can get to it, doesn't do the speed justice. Like how you're telling me is probably close as we'll get. You can't see them. But even I showed my missus on YouTube. I said, and she actually said, what? I said, this happens every year. This is a race around the Isle of Man, and they are doing 200, 240, 250 miles an hour on blind bends where the fucking back wheel is squiggling around everywhere, and there are people dying in front of people on an island, the Isle of Man, just down the road.
Yeah.
Like,
it is bonkers. And some of the, you know, they'll go, there's a great guy called what's his name? Milky Quail. Now, Milky Quail was a really good rider. He won a TT, but then he had a huge crash. And so now he helps organize it. Lovely fella. Looks like the Milky Bar kid. That's what he's getting, the Milky Quail. And he goes around his van, gives you a tour of it. And he goes, and you come around this corner and you see that line there? You see that bit of hedgerow? You want the hedge to brush your leathers on the left side. You dip into the right one. You want just a little bit of graze. You know you've got the right line if the wall has cut your leather a little bit.
Oh,
are you kidding? You can't get it wrong. I mean, there's some of the decapitations, just the most awful, awful things. But it's pure sport. It's the purest sport ever.
The talent that you need. So if you try and stay positive about it and you watch stuff like Top Gun, for example, Bloody Hollywood, Speed, jets, bikes, Days of Thunder. It's all about Tom Cruise, but all the thrills. I look at that and it's like, I'd get in a fighter plane. I'd do that. I'd get in a Formula One car. I'd do that. But I could never do that. And for that reason, it's like the superpowers in my mind that these humans have to be able to do that. But it's skill. It's the skill.
Oh, it's complete skill, yeah. It's complete skill.
Riding a bike's hard. I've ridden a few bikes. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, I just have a fair weather rider, like nothing. But
and all the elements are against you. On a motorbike, everything's against you. A bit of water on a bit of rain on a white line, and you're like your tire squig. Like it's awful. Yeah, look, they're amazing. They are amazing. But there's a great movie called TT 3D Closer to the Edge. If you have a chance, watch it.
And you don't do that anymore. That's not no. Something you
like you know, to be honest with you, it got to me. There was an Australian sidecar rider who was, I think it was his first year at the TT, and he had, so I used to hang with, it's very hard to explain. You'd do a race and then you'd walk around the paddock and you'd start by walking around the factory units, and it was all like very nice coffee machines, all that stuff. But I found myself gravitating towards the lower part of the paddock where there was people in tents and stuff, and you'd just sit down in the grass and have chats with them. This Australian sidecar rider was there with his family and his mum and dad and all that stuff. Lovely people. They had a lovely tent. Look for the good tent. And they had a wooden floor in it. They brought a wooden floor and pallets. And they had a decent kettle. That's a great place for tea. So I go, I'm making this my tea spot for the next week, if you don't. So I go down to them and he'd be polishing the sidecar and all that kind of stuff. And the parents were so proud of him because he came over from Australia, you know. And he died in practice. It was brutal. It was brutal to see them collapse like that. And I had to do his obituary that night. And there was another obituary the next day. And I thought, I actually can't. So did it. I'm saying how great it is and how much I understood it. But for me personally, my character, I can't take any more of it. You know, yeah. I'm not saying it shouldn't exist. And I know it sounds like I'm being a complete hypocrite here about it all. But it got a bit much for me. And then in more media sense, it changed TV company. I felt loyalty to the company I'd been with, and I just felt like the right time. 10 years of anything, you know, it's quite a long time. So, yeah. Yeah. I was doing MotoGP then at that stage as well, which is, you know, same but very, very different. Although it has nasty deaths in that as well, you know.
Yeah.
Look, motorsport's dangerous. But that's, if you're true to yourself, that's one of the thrills of watching it.
Yeah.
If you deny that, you're being...
Of course.
You're not being honest
with
yourself.
Well, that's the thing with rugby, to bring it back to that, not on that scale, but... This is where we need to get to from an understanding point of view of where people are drawn to rugby, because you have some of the biggest humans walking the planet from all walks of life, from all corners of the earth. The vulgarities of it are running over one another, gain line, physical, collisions, these aggressive words that form a game of rugby in a Colosseum-like environment. And I've just find ourselves apologising constantly for it. And not that I'm changing the way that I deliver it, but I see where the growth lies. And yes, the growth lies in mass participation in rugby in different formats, the women's game, and all these things that they're talking about. But in order to sell the game at the very highest level and what sells other sports, what sells boxing, what sells NFL, what sells UFC. Like UFC, I watched UFC at the weekend, Israel Adesanya versus Alex Pereira, ended in a show-stopping knockout. And the celebration around that and the lead-up to that fight around Adesanya getting knocked out before, and they celebrate it, they embrace it. Not that we need to embrace that, because rugby isn't about knocking out another human being, but the speed, the collision, the power, these are things that are hand in hand with entertainment. Because when you look at that as a fan, it's like, well, I could never do that. And there's a romance before where your average man or woman off the street could go to a rugby club and play rugby. I actually quite like the fact now that there is a slight gulf in terms of watching the All Blacks when they're at full click, or Ireland, and the physicality, the runners off nine, and the way that they play, it's almost like the power, the speed, the athleticism. That's what's going to take our game forward. And I just don't think I can be apologetic about that going forward.
I like the physical side of the game. I like the big collisions. It's part of it. You take that away, it becomes a different sport.
Yeah.
I liked it when I played at grassroots level. I was a terrible rugby player, but it was a one place you could go ahead and slam into people and get rid of all that natural kind of energy and need for it. I don't know why we have a need for it. We do. And it felt good. The collisions are part of the game. You want them to be safer. You want them to be lower. But, you know, it is part of it, because that contest, and that's the beauty of rugby. There's contests all over the pitch all the time. There's all these little contests all over the time, all over the place. If it comes everyone just chasing a ball around and watching a ball, we lose out. We lose out what the sport's all about. But yeah, look, we had this chat on air actually with Benny Kay, who's brilliant. And I'm like, we have to accept that the physical side of this game is a very, very important part of this game. It's actually one of the coaches with us. I can't remember who it was. It was one of the senior coaches saying, like, I'm not going to apologize, you know, for this. It's a physical game, and that's just the way it is, you know. Yeah. And actually, our team were more physical than the other team today, and that's why we won, you know. Why, when we watch rugby, do we have to go, oh, that's very dangerous? I don't want any head injuries in rugby, but like, you know, you got a rugby match on, and you're going, that should be a red card, Zayat. But then we celebrate a knockout in UFC hours later on the same television.
And we're selling it.
So why is it okay? Why is a head injury? So in boxing and UFC, you essentially can win by giving someone a head injury because you're knocking them out, which is what we're trying to stop in rugby. So why is it okay in one sport and not in another? What's the difference? Is it because they only box or they only fight maybe once every few months? Explain that to me, because I struggle with that.
Yeah, I think I go back to my point where when you're boxing, or when you're UFC, well, you can win in a few ways in UFC, can't you? Because you can choke someone out to sleep.
Or you can snap that's fine.
Yeah. Or you can snap their arm off. So I think there's a social acceptance, isn't there, around that's what it is. Or boxing. It is like, ultimately, to win that fight, yes, you can win on points, but you don't let it go to the judges is the tagline. Had George Groves in here, we were talking about it. You've got to knock the opposite human out. And I think that is the acceptance, whereas rugby isn't that, is it? Rugby isn't about, as in, you don't win a game by knocking someone out, so you try and mitigate that. But it is interesting that BT, for example, as a sporting media platform, on one side, not only are you having to pay for BT, you're having to pay more on top with these knockout promos to draw you in. But BT aren't making apologies.
Sky's the same, BBC's, ITV, of course. Anyone who has both sports are the same.
But the newspapers as well, like, as exactly. In you look on the back page when Tyson Fury knocked out Deontay Wilder, that's the back page, like, amazing Tyson, the Gypsy King, and then you open it up and there's all this stuff around rugby and how unsafe it is. It's social pressure, isn't it? I think.
But why? I know a lot of this is led by the legal cases from former players, okay? And we're not getting that in boxing, right? No. Because former boxers are not taking the authorities to court over this, right? Because there's an acceptance that they're going to get hit in the head, right? Yeah. Is that why we talk about it so much?
Yeah, I think so. I think that is a big reason. I think participation numbers, in fact, I know participation numbers are dropping. So we've got ourselves in this cycle now, haven't we, of having to do something, having to talk about it, having had referees, had Frank Murphy in here, I've interviewed Luke Pearce, and whether or not they give the full account of how it feels to be in amongst that It's like you've seen some of the red cards, defenders just adjusting Zach Mercer's one where he got red carded. You're like, man, and then it ruins a game, or Freddie Stewart's one where there's a rugby. And a game's been ruined off the back of it. So it isn't just us questioning it. You've got to think the referees in the middle, their minds must be like completely lost, because on the one hand, you've got half of society, it's probably less, probably feels like half or more, just on top of them constantly. You've got to make the game safer.
Yeah.
Social media, it's trial by social media, everything in slow motion. And then obviously the court litigation battles against World Rugby and the unions, is there's this feel to have to do something. And that's, you know, you saw the backlash with the RFU when the high tackle thing was brought in, or to lower it around the waist. And then the World Rugby have now brought in an opt-in option with the sternum. Yeah. As below, because it's just, you imagine the people making these decisions, they don't know where to go, you know, and they're trying to bring people in. Like Ross Tucker came on and brilliant. He gave a 10-minute conversation. He probably needs 3 hours to go through. I think it's the need to do something. But in the need to do something, we're scaring people.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're constantly scaring people. And then, like, even Oz now, like, Oz is calling out big tackles, or high tackles, sorry. Mm. On comms, it's like, oh, mate, Oz, you're making. And then it's like, and then obviously the TMO hears that and it's all stop and it's all slow motion. It's like head collision, the trauma. And then we're constantly feeding the engine of like, oh, it's dangerous. Like, it's dangerous. It's dangerous. And it's becomes.
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because we're being told as well that this is the way the game is now and this is where we're to react. So we have to call out the things that we feel break the laws in the game at the moment. And that's why Oz has to do that. And it's tricky. And I just wonder, can the game grow and remain the same? Or do you, you know, I've heard people say, well, why is everyone worrying about the game growing? Why does it have to grow? Mm. If we just leave it as it is and accept that it's not going to be the biggest sport in the world, but we still have the purity of the sport? Or do we kind of keep sanitizing it because we want more people to play it? You know, there are two options there, right? Yeah,
but and
this I don't know which is the right one, by the way. I don't know which is the right one.
Well, on that, I think they're two different games now, and people don't like them. I think the participation element, whereas when I was younger playing for Scotland, it wasn't that far away from a club player that I played with being able to play at that level. And that's not me, you know, self-deprecation. That is, honestly, whereas now, you look at the gulf between Ardie Surveyor and Jasper Visas and Ebenet Sebeth and Marrow and Genji and the power, you know, all the Ireland team, there's a huge gap. So I don't think we can marry the two up. I think the participation on one side is one thing, but then like you said, it's like, you know, do we have a level of acceptance of rugby is what it is there? You know, do we grow anymore? We're in a weird time, aren't we? Because of we're in the middle of it. And not to draw comparisons to NFL, but they were in it and they got through it, obviously backed by a lot of money and interest, the number one sport in America. But I just find it really difficult because it's what we talk about. Even I find myself drawn to, I don't do it anymore, on social media, calling out wrong decisions, which then breeds negativity, doesn't it, around, and then it highlights...
Yeah.
Other people coming in, you know, the danger of the sports, then the players can't say anything because if they say that it's not a red card or whatever, or I signed up to play rugby, it just causes a stir.
I kind of feel with rugby, we need a few clean years.
Yeah.
Just a few clean years without any scandals, or just give us celebrations of the sport for just a couple of years.
Yeah.
But there's always something. The Freddie Stewart red card was just the epitome of the struggles the game has at the moment.
Mm.
Because, I mean, like, I was there and I never felt England were going to win that game, to be honest with you. Now, I had a few Guinness in me at that stage, but still, I was there as a fan. But it could have been a contest.
Mm.
It could have been. And it was just ruined by that crazy decision.
Ruined.
And then that's it. It was rescinded, but that doesn't matter. You've stolen that moment from
him. Of course.
Stolen that moment from the fans. You've stolen that moment from every single person who watched that game that day, because it might have been a match for 70 minutes. It might have been. But once England went down to 14 men, it was
well, imagine done. The energy drop, not just in the stadium, but everyone watching at home in the pubs.
Yeah.
So as I agree with you, I think Ireland would have went on to win it. But like you said, it was gone.
Yeah.
And that decision was based, as we know now, it was the wrong decision. But that decision was based on fear from the referee's 100%. Point of view. Didn't know what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So if in doubt, send him off.
Red. Yeah, crazy, crazy, crazy decision. And... I felt sorry for him. I was down at the Leinster Tigers game there on Friday, you know, and I thought Freddie Stewart against Hugo Keenan again, and they were blitzed, weren't they? He didn't even get to, they were completely blitzed. They're just so good at the moment, though. Oh. I wonder, like, look, I'm from Leinster, right? And I love to see what's happening, but I wonder sometimes, is it even good for the game having a team that is so much better than everyone else? Toulouse look great, okay?
Yeah.
And La Rochelle still have that big power game, but my word, they are a different level.
They're unplayable. If you get them, Leinster or Ireland now, and I say this when you think we've got teams like France, like we've got Toulouse, we've got the All Blacks, you've got the world champion South Africa with the players they've got. You've seen it, haven't you? You went into camp as well.
But you go into camp and you look at the players. You're just sitting there. It was really cool. It was before the French game, and sitting there with Brian O'Driscoll and Davey Irwin, who played back in the day in the 80s with Ireland. But we stood at the top of the room, and you're looking across the quality of players and the number of them. You're almost going, there's 3 12s. There's four, you know, number eights. It's like backup. And then at the back of the room, the coaching staff, Andy Farrell. Oh, how good is Andy Farrell? He's come through. He's complete meritocracy for him to be where he is. He's learned all the way through. Simon Easterby. Mm-hmm. Simon Easterby captained Ireland. Let's not forget that. He's a British and Irish line. He's been through the coaching structure with different clubs. And he's part of that panel. It's Paul O'Connell. You've played against Paulie.
And he's third in line to what we're... He's third. You mentioned him third. We've hardly mentioned him.
Richie Murphy, who's been with Leinster and Ireland for so many years. Finney Hammond. Got to be one of the best video analysts, but he's been around for a long, long time. There is out there. It's such a good panel. It's right across the board. And then the under-20s go and blitz absolutely everybody. So you think, and those guys, the way rugby is now, they might be under 20. They could be ready in a year.
Mm.
Could be ready in a year or two. You know what I mean? It's just nuts. The domination is going to continue for a long time. But also, I was thinking about this the other day. It's people talk about Irish rugby. It's really primarily Leinster rugby because Munster are not flying at the moment. And Connacht are, well, they're not in the Champions Cup, you know. And Ulster, well, they're well beaten in that game, you know. So it's Leinster. It's Leinster. And they make up the most of Ireland at the moment. So even in Ireland, it's not the whole, every province playing brilliant rugby, you know. It's kind of this Leinster pod in the middle of it all,
Crazy. We've had a big Irish contingent across the podcast that we've been doing and chatting to Bernard Chapman. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I did watch Shoulder to Shoulder, and we were talking with Bernard about how Andy Farrell, an Englishman, the irony in that, one of the greatest Englishmen probably walking the planet, has managed to emotionally engage with the team. And you mentioned you went into the camp for the game against France. I watched Shoulder to Shoulder. I've always been really interested in the landscape of Ireland. And I might have mentioned it to you, and just for the listeners, I've got an affiliation. My sister was born in Northern Ireland, in Antrim. My dad was in the military. We lived in Londonderry. But I went. Right. I know. That's what I mean. What?
Derry.
The Protestants call it Londonderry, though, don't they? Or is it the other way around? We're going very political here. I apologise. I always get called up on it. I know it as Londonderry. Why do I only know it as Londonderry, not Derry?
Because your father was in the military.
Okay.
So, unionists would know. Those who want to be a part of the United Kingdom would call it Londonderry.
Yes, that's why I get called out.
Republicans, who are primarily Catholics as well, will call it Derry.
Mm.
The city of Derry. What they do call it is Stroke City, as in Derry stroke Londonderry. So you just call it Stroke City.
I'll do that from now on.
There's your middle ground, there's your safe ground.
Yes, yeah. I will stick to the safe ground, but I lived there. I lived there for maybe 3 or 4 years when my mum and dad divorced. My dad was overworking in Stroke City, undercover and these things. So I was privy to a lot of stuff that was happening. I mean, we're talking the 80s and 90s. In that documentary, Shoulder to Shoulder, I thought it was brilliant because it gave me a kind of deeper understanding of what guys like Willie John McBride went through. I had no idea. Like, I know he's a legend, right? And I know there was a conversation between him and the late, great David Duckham about that game going ahead. Like, these kind of, you know, after dinner tales that you hear, and you think, oh, obviously polished a little bit, but it's a kind of two-pronged question, really. Mm. Like, how cool was it, if you can say cool, was it to make that documentary and have Brian O'Driscoll? I sent him a picture, a screenshot of him playing the drums. I was like, I said, Brian, you looked, was it as uncomfortable as it looked for you on screen? But it is still a thing, right? And that's the crazy thing around Ireland that we say, look, England, Scotland and Wales border each other, but just the Ireland thing has always really interested me because it's one island.
Yeah, I mean, we have a production company, Brian O'Driscoll and I, called Three Rock, and that was our first documentary. And the genesis of that was, I guess, that we made it with another company called TBI, and Isabel Williams and Mark Sherman were on board with us, and they were absolutely brilliant on it. And it was great to have their perspective as English people and us two Irishmen, and, you know, to sit alongside each other and tell this story. I guess the genesis was a lot of people saying to me, when they play Aron na Bhean, which translates, that's Gaelic, it means the soldier song, which is really a Republican song, why do not all the players sing it? It's our anthem, and that's why we have Ireland's Call. Not everyone sings it, because if you're from Northern Ireland, Ulster, it's a Republican song. It means you're essentially, it's an anti-British song. It's an anti-occupation song. So they won't sing it. And that's, you see them being kind of tight-lipped. And Ireland's Call was written to represent the entire island of Ireland, the 32 counties. Currently, the Republic of Ireland is 26 counties, and it is a republic. Northern Ireland is 6 counties, and it's still part of the United Kingdom. It should be ruled by its own government, Stormont, which hasn't sat in such a long time. So it's essentially ruled from England. But it's and then we have the border. And that was all part of the treaty in 1921 that was signed after many, many years of conflict between Ireland and England. Going back hundreds of years, you know, England came over, Brits came over, and they occupied Ireland. They pushed a majority of the population out to the west where the land was bad. The only thing you could really grow around there. Now, this is a very potted history, okay? So don't be pulling up my own facts here. I'm just trying to give you the 10 seconds.
So you can sell it to me.
So, you know, you push people onto bad land. One of the few things you could grow there was potatoes, and they could grow in bad soil, and people survived on that. Meanwhile, all the good crops were all being shipped back over to England. And we had a famine in 1847 where 1.5 million people died, men, women, children, particularly children, because parents, in their innocence, there was no food. There was potatoes grown on poor soil, and they were thinking a lot of the cases they were giving kids the middle of the potatoes. They thought it was the good bit. Of course, all the nutrition was in the skins. And there were kids dying in ditches, and it was just such a horrendous time. And people were being kicked out of their homes for not paying rent. It's such a deep and long and horrendous piece of history. You'd have to read up on it. I'm giving you the potted version. Also, 1 million people emigrated. So a huge chunk of this small country, don't forget, we're only 5 million now, left or died. And the real battle, the battle had been going on for a long time for our complete independence. There was a rising in 1916, which failed, but ultimately was the start of the victory. And in 1921, a treaty was signed where the Republic of Ireland became the 26 counties, but the United Kingdom was allowed to keep the top 6, because obviously there are a lot of Protestants up north and they wanted their space and they didn't want to be living in a republic. You can understand their fears as well. And we have this situation where the country is divided. And then the Catholics who were living in areas like Derry weren't being treated terribly well during that time. There were a lot of civil rights issues and they protested. And then we had all the shootings and innocent people being shot by British forces. Now, there were obviously bombs and innocent people killed on both sides. So there's a lot of blood on a lot of people's hands. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you what happened up there. You know, the Troubles were a horrible, horrible time where a lot of people died and they shouldn't have died. And it's all, you know, it's still raw for an awful lot of people. It's not that long ago. But during this whole time, Ireland had one rugby team, which is an incredible thing. So Republicans, people who wanted Ireland to be the 32 counties and have nothing to do with the United Kingdom, were playing alongside people who were part of Northern Ireland and wanted it to be part of the United Kingdom. So you had Republicans and you had Loyalists playing in the same rugby team, which meant you had someone who had IRA leanings playing alongside someone who might have been a part of the British Army or part of the Northern Irish Police Force, the RUC at the time. It's completely mad that should happen, but because they are playing with that Ireland jersey, they came together. So that jersey allowed them to do something that politicians couldn't achieve, that the church couldn't achieve, that paramilitaries couldn't achieve. Sport allowed them come together. Also, the entire country followed the team and would cheer for the team. It's the one time they'd all cheer for the same thing. I mean, it's completely bonkers when you think of it. Then you have 1987, where it was just actually the build-up to the World Cup, the first World Cup. And there was a training camp in Dublin. And the Ulster team, some of the Ulster lads were coming down for training. Nigel Carr, brilliant, brilliant back row, was on his way down with Davy Irwin. And they were crossing the border on their way into the Republic. It just happened to be at the other time a judge was coming up with his wife. And the IRA targeted the car with a bomb. The car blows up, but it also hits Davy Irwin and Nigel Carr's car. And Davy Irwin's dragging Nigel Carr out of the vehicle. The lads are in Dublin training, going, where are the lads? Where are they? They're meant to be here. You know, giving out about them. Little as they realised, they'd nearly died in this incident. Nigel Carr never played rugby again. Mm. Didn't go to the World Cup. But they continued to play together. So they were able to overcome that. Sport and rugby allowed all that. And essentially, that's what the documentary is about. It's about Brian's understanding of that. Because I guess to us in Dublin, you know, we're oblivious to a lot of it. It was only up the road, an hour and a half up the road. We were oblivious to a lot of the problems. There were bombs in Dublin. There were innocent people who were killed in Dublin. Mm-hmm. But, you know, up north, it was vicious. John McBride, he worked in a bank and he talks about being in the middle of Belfast and being told to get out. And he came out and there'd be a huge explosion and bits of car flying through the air and embedding itself in walls.
He didn't know where to go.
Didn't know where to go. Yeah. There was nowhere to go because the bomb would go off in one place and then another one would go off where they were trying to... I mean... Both sides did a lot of bad things. Both sides did a lot of bad things. We're now celebrating the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement.
Mm.
Thank goodness. And when peace arrived, it was just a massive thing because it's just a horrible, horrible time. But the rugby team played throughout that whole time and represented both sides of a warring community, which is an incredible feat. So when we went into camp that night, we just spoke about that. And I just said, this jersey's magic. There's a magic powers, you know. So think about that. And so it was a pretty special night. There was a lot of special things said by players. Very emotional evening. I wasn't surprised they beat France. I think they could have played them on the Tuesday and won because they were very, very focused and fired up. It was very, very special. I mean, look, I'm always really nervous talking about Irish history because it sounds so bonkers and you want to get everything right all the time. But it's such a complex story. It's impossible to give a potted history of it. So look, I would recommend you watch Shoulder to Shoulder. Go and find it on BT Sport and have a watch of it because it tells the story very, very well. But symbolism is obviously huge up there. So the Orange Parades are massive up on July the 12th up in Northern Ireland. Jim, you would have been there.
Yeah, I've been to Bogside. I've been to these places. Yeah,
so you've seen what it's like.
I have, yeah.
So it's celebrating William of Orange's victory over the Catholic forces.
Why have I said Bogside? Is that where they do... some of them.
Bogside Bogside is one side of it. So Derry, around the walls of the city, you've got. Yeah. But it's when you look down, it's primarily Catholic areas, as far as I remember. And there's little, it's weird, you know, because of these little patches.
It's
where there's like Union Jacks flying and then the Republican flags are flying. And then sometimes you look out and the Republican areas are flying Palestinian flags as well. And it's just the whole...
It's a tribalism still.
Symbolism.
Symbolism.
Massive, massive, massive. Mm. So the Orange Parades, it's basically like, it's kind of banging drums and all that kind of malarkey and it's a bit of a parade, but the symbolism is huge. And it can be antagonistic because they march through a lot of Republican areas because they say that's their categorical right to march through those areas because traditionally they've always done that. And believe it or not, in most places, it's absolutely fine. It's absolutely fine. People respect that. We went to Loch Gall, which is largely a Protestant area, and they have a huge parade there. And actually, we were warmly welcomed. And it was like a big family day. I got to be honest with you. There was nothing antagonistic about it. But for Brian and I, as Catholic boys from the South, we're in this area and they all wear these orange sashes and bowler hats and they bang these big drums. And it's kind of intimidating, but then you kind of get used to it a little bit. I did say to Brian, don't touch anything. Just don't touch anything. And next thing you see, he's got the lambeg drum and he's hitting it. I'm thinking, oh my God.
His face said it all.
I mean.
Fair play to him though.
Well, yeah, look, sometimes you got to walk in another man's shoes, right? And he did it. But my word, the backlash was unbelievable. His life was threatened. His family were threatened. You know, I used to think you're a legend. You're nothing to me now. How dare you do that? Bah, 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 bah. But somebody had to do that. You know, somebody has to eat the first oyster, right? In the world. Somebody has to try this. And I think a lot of good came from that because it started a conversation.
Full respect to him. And I think when I listen to you talk, I purposely not said anything apart from a few anecdotes of me going because it is so fresh.
Mm.
And it was a war, right?
It was a war.
That's what it was. And people forget that this happened not so long ago. Mm-hmm. And the people that you interview in the documentary, you can say, oh, no, we're over it now. No. They're not over it. As in the country, there's still that divide. And I find it really interesting around when you were, how do you pronounce it? Long?
Oh, Lockall.
Lockall. Yeah. So I find it really interesting where Brian was thrown. And I could see that it was deep rooted in Brian because he was asking, well, what happens when Ireland play rugby? And it's like, well, we support Ireland. Or what happens when the Republic of Ireland play football and England play against England? And you could see they were like, they were saying they supported England, right? And you could see that Brian was fucking raging.
Yeah, he was,
So that showed me how close to the now that even though it's gone and it's passed, but there are these still these underlying kind of deep-rooted emotions around it. Like, you know, Rory Best is talking, Willie John McBride's taking you on the streets of Belfast where he worked, where the bank, where the bombings were happening. Like, this has happened in a generation that we still know. And listening to Bernard Chapman talk about you lads going in to speak, present, and talk about these deep-rooted things that are so fresh, how powerful that was. And I was completely blown away and thrown. So when you're there talking to Andy Farrell, I don't know how much he knows. He's obviously a smart bloke. He would have looked into it. What was it like for you and Brian O'Driscoll, one of the greatest players, being in that environment, talking to these young lads? These lads are probably out of that generation now, but you know, their grandparents or even their parents would have been a part of it. But how powerful, like, could you feel the emotion? And if so, why? Why do you think that was?
Yeah, I mean, Andy said very little, actually. Smart man. He just let it happen. We had a great guy called Paul Rice with us, who's a historian in University College Dublin, and he did 10 minutes up the top, kind of giving here's the lie of the land. Here's the lie of land. And I brought some snippets from the documentary. I said, right, so here was the situation. This is how the country was divided. And then once we started talking, you could see them, okay, hang on. This is recently. You know, this isn't, we're talking 70s and 80s here, right? When Davy Irwin spoke, when he spoke about pulling Nigel Carr out of a burning car, saving his life, looking over at a burnt-out car where Judge and his wife had just been murdered, and still being prepared to go down to Dublin at a later date, obviously, pull on that green jersey and play for the entire island of Ireland. And Doc was nearly in tears, you know, telling these guys that story, that's just the severity and the drama and the terrifying moment for him, but still the power of the jersey was big enough for Davy Irwin to come back and play for Ireland and represent the island. There wasn't a sound. What was really interesting was Ireland's call, because there would be a lot of people in Ireland who go, I'm not singing that shite. What's that song? Phil Coulter song, Ireland's Call. No, Aaron Levine, Soldier Song, that's our song. What the documentary tried to do was explain to people why we have to have another song. Because it has to represent the entire team. It has to represent the entire 32 counties of Ireland. And it's really, really important that we respect that. Whether you like the tune or not, it doesn't matter a damn. It's the importance of that tune and unifying people and how important that role is. And I think the players really bought into that. And that's great because the players all belt out Ireland's Call. And when the fans at home see their heroes singing it, they start singing it. They're leading by example. That was the greatest thing I took from that night. It was really, really special. Also, just to see these guys, because like I see them all the time. You see them all the time, Jim. But when you see them in a collective like that, it's very impressive to see a team.
Well, they
like
are.
That.
I mean, they are impressive.
I just love what he's done. I love what he's done with that team and the importance of it to the players and the importance of the jersey and the realization how lucky they are, you know, to play international rugby. And I think Andy respects how lucky he is as well to be doing what he's doing. You know, they all realize it's a huge privilege to be in the space they're in. And that's, you could feel that night and the respect out of them. They queued up and each one of them shook our hands at the end of the night. It was fabulous.
Yeah, so yeah, cool.
It was really, really cool. It was really, really cool. So yeah, it's funny, you know, it's such a complex story. My own grandfather, my son had to do, I was wary of telling this because I don't know if people understand. It just seems so alien now, I guess. But my son had to do an essay for his A-levels in a part of history that you know, isn't in the kind of main history books. And he didn't know what to do it about. And I have a bullet that was fired over my grandfather's grave because now, bear in mind, there's what we call the old IRA, which are the ones who fought for our independence, which the new IRA were doing, but terrorism's a different vibe to the way it was back in the 1800s and early 1900s, okay? So you kind of got your pre-treaty IRA, we call the old IRA. And my grandfather was a part of that. And he had a full IRA military funeral and a bullet fired over the grave. And my uncle made up bullets for us when we were babies. And I still have that. So I said, can you find out more about the bullet? Because my mother never, she goes, oh, he used to just mind a gate. He never did anything. Because what happened was when the treaty was signed in 1921 and there was partition, there was the pro-treaty and the anti-treaty. So Michael Collins was pro-treaty. He said, I've signed this. We've given away six counties, but look, we still have these. We have still have these 26. Eamon de Valera was the other side. He was anti-treaty. He said, no, we want the whole bloody lot. And then there was a civil war between them all. So after hundreds of years of fighting for independence, they got an almost independence, full independence. Then there was a civil war and you had the two sides fighting each other. And there was a lot of shame and embarrassment attached to that because they should have been heroes for what they achieved. But then you've got these communities at war again within themselves and divided again. So my grandfather would have been part of the old IRA. He would have been anti-treaty. So no one spoke about them. You know, so my mother never spoke about what he did. We never knew. So I said, could you find out what the bullet's all about? And my son, when he did his research, they opened the military archives in Kew in London and all the information was there. And it turned out that my grandfather fought in the Easter Rising, in, you know, 1916 with his brother as a 17-year-old. But his father was a British military officer who changed religion to marry my great grandmother. But the boys were educated in the British officer school in Dublin. But even through that, realised they had Republican leanings and they were part of the IRA.
Crazy.
during the rising. Now, again, those of you listening at home, we have old IRA, we have new IRA. They're very different worlds, okay? So we're talking about old IRA here. And yeah, it seems like there's all these amazing court reports about my grandfather refusing to take his hat off because it was a British court, you know, before independence. And just like these crazy things, he had a limp. He had a bad leg, and he used to. We were told he was kicked by a horse. He wasn't kicked by a horse. You know, it came by other means.
Shot in the leg.
Ireland is full of these stories because we're a small country. So nearly everybody had a family member involved in these things, but they're never spoken about. So the younger generation now are able to look back at a lot of this stuff without judgment as this historical thing that happened and changed our country forever. And it's really interesting seeing their view on it. You know, it really is because we just wouldn't talk about it. You just wouldn't talk about it. I remember even when I was in college over here, there were still bombs, Canary Wharf bombs. You know, you'd be so embarrassed. You'd be scared to speak. There was a pub around the corner from when I was in college in the Elephant Castle. They wouldn't serve me because I was Irish, you know. And, you know, I remember the bomb at Canary Wharf thinking, I can hardly blame them, you know. Can hardly blame them. They're, you know, it was weird. So I'm kind of this new generation. They're the ones who really bring us peace because they don't, you know, their new world's a nicer one for the most part, isn't it? You know, when you look back at the island. Quite a monologue there, Jim, to pick amongst the bones of. Mate, I hope it makes sense.
I could listen to it for days.
What was your, when you, as a Englishman, Scotsman, Englishman, Scotsman?
Scotsman, Englishman.
Did you feel intimidated when you lived up there? You did?
Yes.
In what way did you, how did that manifest itself?
Well, I had an English accent for one, very big. My dad was in the military, so that obviously causes issues if they know. The big thing that I found really interesting was they'd never say like Catholic, Protestant, which are the two big things that were asked in terms of what side are you on effectively. Mm. It'd be what football team do you support? That's how they...
Celtic or Rangers.
Celtic, Rangers, yeah. Man United, Liverpool. It was... Craig, that's right, Man United, Liverpool, right?
Yeah.
So I was just like, Coventry City, that was it.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, wonderful country. Wonderful country. But I had a snapshot of that energy. And I suppose you look at a country like Ireland and the estates and the council estates and the kind of deep-rooted history. It's a wild, wild place. And looking at and watching the Shoulder to Shoulder documentary brought things back for me that I'd seen. Like I'd been around Bogside. I was taken around in one of these armoured vehicles. I was really interested in the stuff. But I'll be honest, when I was at the waterside, which is Derry, I did feel a little bit vulnerable. But that was just because of the information and the knowledge that I had. But incredibly powerful to watch that and to watch Brian O'Driscoll in that documentary in a completely different manner, I suppose, and be with his teammates, which were iconic in an Irish jersey, but you could, even though there was no difference, but you could sense like there was a deep-rooted difference. I thought it was really cool. I thought it cool in a good way.
Yeah, but he wasn't as sure-footed all the time.
No, he wasn't.
Which we're used to seeing with him, you know.
Exactly that. Mm. There was like this kind of uncomfortable smile, but understanding how important that story is to Ireland's story as a rugby team. I suppose I probably wouldn't be speaking about it now if I hadn't heard that you guys went into the team and spoke about that and Andy Farrell opened up and the whole thing around, it's not my team, it's my Ireland, which is now the term that they're going by. Is that right? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
So that's the worry for the World Cup now, you know, as in not that the pressure's on because you look at the lay of the land with the pool, but you look at how the team are playing. You look at the fact that these things, these emotional and authentic, I suppose, things are being thrown into the mix. Not only is Andy Farrell engaging with the players, he's engaging with the media, he's engaging with history, like these things that...
are like so behind this rugby team.
Imagine, you think of everything gone by. I don't know what success looks like for Ireland as a country because you've had a lot of success in rugby, winning Six Nations, winning Grand Slams, Leinster. What does winning a World Cup look like for the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland? How does that look? You know, is it as big? And again, I'm just off the back of watching the doc, so I'm all in on the emotion. But watching that, I'm thinking, how does that look if Ireland can win a World Cup for the country?
Honestly, I well up at the thought of it.
Mm. Yeah.
I can barely cope with the thought of that.
Yeah.
Because we're just over 5 million people, you know. We're not. It's not huge.
You think about what the country's been through, and that's what I got from the dot. Whether or not that's what it was meant to be, but I thought you've got this small island in the middle of nowhere, next to another small island that has England, Scotland, Wales. That's divided. That is now the number one rugby nation, the number one rugby team, producing the best rugby players in the world.
It's not even our number one sport. This is the crazy thing. Yeah. We got Gaelic games, you know, ahead of us. We got soccer ahead of us, but
at the helm.
But you know, it's deeper than that, Jim.
Mm.
It's deeper than that because we had decades and decades where everyone told us we were shite. You look at the old Punch magazine cartoons from back in the day and how Irish people were depicted physically, the cartoons like Neanderthals, you know. Irish jokes, thick people. Ah, Paddy's thick. Paddy's, that's so offensive. Potato jokes, so offensive. Because that was the only food that people could feed their family with. The blight in 47, so even potatoes wasn't gross. So literally, they had no food and 1.5 million people died. And when I'm at a rugby game and someone goes, hey, potato, I'm like,
fucking hell.
But I have to smile it off because they just don't know.
But they don't know.
No, but it's really offensive, right? But again, we're terrible at, it's just a bit of crack though. Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it's the best way of dealing with it. But we are put down. 80s Ireland you'd finish school, you finish university, you'd leave. You go to America, you go to Australia, you go to London. You know, in London, we're seen as road builders, navvies. That's what we're seen as. The way we've grown, the captains of industry, you know, look at it, you know, British Airways, you know, Selfridges, whatever it is, run by Irish people. The role we have around the world now is massive. The role Ireland has for big industry, Google, you know, PayPal, everything, it's all in Dublin. Like, I know there are tax reasons for this, but still it had to be done. It had to be done. The deals had to be cut. There had to be a bit of a wiggle room to bring these companies in, and there had to be big conversations, and there had to be a lot of bravery.
I was going to say risk.
Bravery, because we were still part of the European Union, but we still had to kind of keep our own corporate tax rates to bring these people in. So there had to be a little bit of fight amongst this tiny country. And we've these huge, huge companies in Ireland now. We've people coming back to live there because they can have brilliant jobs there. And we're proud of ourselves. We celebrate ourselves worldwide now. We're proud of what we've done. We don't go around hiding our light under a bushel anymore. And actually, this rugby team is almost the epitome of that. We're okay being favourites for a World Cup now. It used to be, well, look, we'd be okay for 60 minutes, the last 20 minutes in the match, God knows, you know. We're not like that anymore. So I think ideologically we've changed as a country. I think our confidence has grown. We've grown up. When the Queen came to visit Ireland, was one of the most fantastic moments, because you have to be confident to allow the old enemy back in. And she was celebrated. Every inch of Irish pavement she walked, she was celebrated. And that showed that we had grown up and we had confidence, and Britain had too. And I just thought it was such a seminal moment in our history. And it's been so good since then for the country. And it's such a great, great time. So winning a Rugby World Cup and where we are would be just this lovely big cherry on top of that cake at the moment. Because it hasn't always been great, but it's, my word, it's been an incredible 40 years, really, you know. So, yeah, let's see what happens. Fuck, if we lose another quarter, that would be in bits.
Oh, I'm supporting Ireland, just to let you know. Are you? Apart from the first game. It's not the first game, is it? Scotland's first game, South Africa. Maybe the last game. I need to look at the fixture list. But I'll be supporting Scotland for that game. And then we'll meet again in the final. And then,
like, let's see what happens there. We're all friends then. But it's what worries me about the World Cup is, like, I don't really know what New Zealand are up to. What are they up to over there?
What's going on? In the studio here, we've had a few discussions, and that's the one. Yeah, New Zealand's the one. It's brewing. Well, they are doing good things, apart from the fact that their coach has already been told he's not being kept on. So is that unrest? Beauden Barrett's not in form, from what I'm reading, not seeing what I'm reading, whether or not that means he's out of form. But it's the All Blacks. They're the one.
And South Africa.
South Africa. Are they the same team? I mean, they're the champions.
But they will be.
Yeah, they will. Of course they will.
You know they're going to be,
of course,
right?
They will.
That's a lot of traffic. That's a lot of traffic for Ireland to deal with. You have to win so many games in a row to win a Rugby World Cup in a very short space of time.
Yeah.
Now we have a great squad, but injuries, there will be injuries. I'm so panicked by Cardiff quarterfinal, Argentina 2015. And we had a load of injuries. We lost Paulie, and there was a lot of players playing out of position, and we were just done that day. And if we had our full team out, I think we would have been okay. So it's, you need so many things to go right for you. So, so many things. Look how long it was for New Zealand to win a World Cup again. It took a long, long time. England have only won one.
Exactly. It's not easy.
Look how good, how many great players have gone through. It's really hard to win a Rugby World Cup.
And that's why it's so special.
It is, yeah.
And that's why going through the archives and listening to you speak, the enormity of it, not that we want any of the players listening to this to put more pressure on them, but mate, that's a long old podcast. I've missed my flight.
Have we started?
That's it. I've missed my flight, so we can keep going. So we'll come back for
part
two.
What? You've missed a flight?
Yeah, don't worry. That's fine.
I don't even know what time it is. It's like being at a casino in Vegas here.
It's unreal. Yeah. Apart from, as in, I gain knowledge and don't lose money. So,
all right.
Craig Doyle, absolute pleasure and honour to have you in the studio, mate. Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. I've no idea what happened, but it was great fun.
We'll find out when it hits the headlines. Okay, cheers, mate.
Thanks.